Hey friends, welcome to Cashing In on Content Marketing. I'm Amanda Milligan, the marketing director at Fractal. And every week on the show, I interview marketing experts about ways to know the value of your work and get buy-in for your strategies. This week, we're exploring how to improve your content by gathering insights from social media and social data. To walk us through this topic, we're joined by Adrian Shears, the digital strategist and owner principal of VV May Labs. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to chat with you. We were talking a little bit before the show about how social is not my forte, aside from me just being on Twitter for in a personal capacity.
Yeah, that's a pretty good crash course though.
Yeah, you learned some stuff just DIYing it, but I really love to hear from others in the industry on their take on this. So I kind of wanted to start with some general questions. How often are you creating content like specifically for social channels or advising clients to do that, as opposed to taking what's already existing and trying to promote it on social? Like, how often would you say both are occurring?
That's a good question. So unfortunately, my answer is it depends. So for some clients, one in particular has like a magazine. It has like a whole, you know, articles, blogs, video team, all that stuff. So there's lots and lots of content that's being made. However, my preference is really social first content, which means it's designed with social in mind. Meaning, for example, one of my clients works with an agency that's amazing with advertising. And so they frequently make videos that are shown on Hulu, Inside the Beltway, or what have you. And then they give us the video to work with for social, which is great. But when they think TV first, video doesn't do as well. And what I mean by that is thinking of what the audience is or what they're like on social. And of course, that's going to vary between your Instagrams and your Twitter. So unfortunately, it really depends. I think my suggestion is one, having social first content. If you don't have social first content, it's really repurposing. So lots and lots of repurposing, especially when client or when I've been in-house, social is unfortunately the last on the list. Mm-hmm. So kind of figuring out how we can make it work, whether it's pulling out some quotes or making GIFs or even doing really quick videos based off of a blog post and just getting someone with a mobile phone. It doesn't necessarily have to be fancy. It really is just the quality and what your audience wants.
Yeah, so let's dive into that a bit more. When you say social first, what are some of the considerations somebody needs to have if they're listening and they're like, okay, yeah, you're right. I probably should allocate more content specifically to the social audience. What are some of the things they need to consider when planning that?
Yeah, I think they need to consider who the audience is. So even though at a company, your audience is probably the same, right? Like the customer. However, there's different personalities, if you will, or different expectations or different wants, right? So email and social, it could overlap. It could also not overlap. So I'll think of a particular example of one client that is very, the particular audience that I work with, they are activists, meaning picture child of the 60s, they were burning their bras type of thing. And, you know, now they're older. Mm-hmm. So content like that, or for them, they expect it to be more inflammatory. They expect an action. They expect urgency versus maybe on the email list, it's clearly segmented. So the larger population is okay with just an update. Giving just an update to this audience, they're like, okay, that's the problem. What can we do? We need more information. So I think that would kind of be an example of you. And to make that call, you really need to know your audience. So I say not just look at data as far as dashboard information, as far as clicks and what have you, but really looking at the qualitative data of how are people responding to content. We had one particular campaign that was really education campaign, really about a particular issue and you know, educating people about it. And so knew it was time to shift our social content strategy, quite frankly, because our audience told us it was time. They're like, you have told us about this problem over and over and over again. What's the solution? What can we do? So with that information, we're like, okay, we need to come up with content that is for the solution. I think the other thing is to think about of what are people's habits on social and, or what are your own habits on social? You don't need to be a social media person to just pay attention to what attracts you. Typically, it's probably fun because if you're at work all day, tired. So kind of thinking you're not just competing against, you know, your competitor, you're competing against someone's cat video. You're competing against someone's dancing video. You're competing for people's time. Mm-hmm. So kind of the other question is, if I didn't work here or this wasn't my project, would I click on it? Would I interact with it? Anything like that are the questions that I like to ask. And so thinking about length, I'm not as huge a stickler. I know, I don't know if it was 5 years ago, but it was kind of like, don't make content above 60 seconds. But I found myself with, you know, fun videos or really engaging videos doing more. So it's not really the length. I mean, you know, clearly you don't want to be too long, but it's more what you're saying, how it's delivered. You know, can you do it within people's attention span?
Yeah, I love that answer. If somebody's kind of in the earlier stages of their social strategy and they're not getting that feedback yet, where they already have engaged audiences that are kind of saying like, hey, give us something different. How can they go about kind of understanding their audience through social?
They can start with listening. And even if they don't have an audience, maybe the audience that they would like to attract would be a good one. Before your audience is established. And so typically I use Twitter for, you know, some deep, you know, quick learning. I also have used Crimson Hexagon and other tools, Sprinklr, on particular topics to kind of feel what are they interested in or what are they saying? And if they're saying, I do a lot of business to business work. So pain points are my bread and butter, kind of looking at what are their pain points, but then also how do they deliver it? Because you could come, you know, in your white horse, like, hello, I'm here to solve your problems. But you also kind of want to have empathy, in my opinion, like that you get what their pain point is and you feel for them and you're here. I feel like that human element mm-hmm. really does it. And I think it's really just trial and error. So you might not have the rich conversations, but see, like with your data, and I think there's a few layers you could do. I call it like the surface data, which is like the clicks, the, you know, that may not be like something to write home about, but it gives me some type of indication that they're interested in something, or maybe I'm going in the right direction. The deeper analytics, if you have it, is website track, you know, did they go to the website? Did they convert? Did they do anything? What have you? And if you're not getting any of that, then maybe you need to try something else out.
Yeah, this actually leads into another question I was going to ask you, which is there are all these discussions often, especially when you were talking about measuring the impact of content, about vanity metrics. And I see that social things come up a lot, like including views, like you mentioned. What is your take on that? Do you think that some things that are normally classified as vanity metrics actually do kind of tell an underlying story? Like what do you think is good to focus on?
I call them indicator metrics, right? Mm-hmm. Like, clearly, if you work at a for-profit organization, the bottom goal for everyone is sales, or the bottom goal is customer retention, you know, and everything short of that is, I guess, quote unquote, vanity, since it didn't technically make you money. However, that information is still valuable to get people to the buy point or whatever the goal is. So if I'm saying people are fired up, you know, and they're commenting, I feel like, you know, you've hit a nerve. And with that information, that can be used throughout the organization of like, hey, in the sales material, focus on this. In the email blast that's going up, this angle seemed to do really well, might do well here. Everything for messaging. So I think maybe in the last few years, it's hard for me to say because everything's been digital since I've been doing social media marketing or just marketing in general. But we have so much information now, thanks to like Google Analytics, thanks to all these great tools, that it's almost like maybe 20, 30 years ago, you might have not as much information, but you knew something was leading towards your goal. And I think now, because we have like these lovely dashboards, that people are like, well, I don't care about anything that doesn't drive sales. But it's like, especially depending how expensive it is, you know, the first, you know, the tweet, like someone's not buying $15,000 of products. So yeah, I think it's an indicator of what's going on. And just because there's correlation and not causation doesn't mean it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I really like that perspective. And you're leading into kind of the meat I wanted to get into in this episode, which is using that kind of social data to go back and inform your content strategy. So if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, I want to do that, what is this kind of setup that they need? You know, you mentioned Google Analytics, like how do they need to make sure they have the structure to be pulling this data in and gathering these insights?
Yeah, it really, of course, is going to vary across organizations. Some people have like a full analytics team that's separate from social or separate from marketing, which is a little strange, but I've seen it all. Different bosses care about different things, or different clients care about different things. So some want me to go more granular than others. So I think the first step is setting up the ability to track. And I always like to track more than I need, because it's very difficult to go back in time. So what things that I do a couple of different trackings. I do social only tracking, which is, it's not going down to the meat of maybe the business, but just really staying in the social sphere. And I categorize all my data from the campaign, from the video type, or I'm sorry, the content type, who produced the video, because sometimes I'm looking at, you know, are some videos outperforming others and does it have something to do with who produced it? You can go as granular as you want. Thanks to, I use Google Sheets and Excel, and I just export the data from Facebook and Twitter. And I think that's primarily what I track. But I guess anything that has Excel, or you can export or put it in Excel and make pivot tables to kind of look at what's going on. For others that need to go deeper, I love Google Analytics. And so Google Analytics is a lot easier than it used to be. Like I went in there the other day, hadn't used it in a while. And I went in and I was like, oh, like this is way more user-friendly. I think they already have templates in there for you to track social. And I use either a tracking link or a pixel if it's paid, and definitely make sure that I'm more granular, because I want to know exactly, like, I don't want to know, oh, it was Twitter. I want to know it was Twitter, the taco campaign from the, kickoff day, you know, mm-hmm. what have you. So as many tags as I can get in there, as possible. And I think you're more successful if you do this a little at a time, meaning like every week, like I go back and make sure things are tagged and updated, because by the end of the month or the end of the quarter, you do not want to be going back and doing all the work, a quarter's worth of work. So it's just easier if like, oh, okay, every few days or every week. And then from there, looking at the information, but not just like, oh, this went up, this went down, really looking at why something happened. And the way you do that is A, just looking either at the data, but also keeping in mind there's external things. So for example, like January 6th, there was, some scuffle at the Capitol. So if you're going back in time, the correct answer of why maybe metrics went down wouldn't probably be, oh, our tweets weren't good. It was probably that no one cared because people were busy. So it could be external things, or, people went to buy something. The buy link didn't work. That's not the social team's fault. So kind of looking into why something is and going back and like, I'm seeing a dip here. What happened that day, either within in the company's control or outside the company's control?
So you've explained kind of how to use that trend data to add context and see what might be going on. And you talked about how you can also get a sense of topics that are doing well based on engagement. Are there any, is there anything else you can be tracking with these tags? I know you mentioned content type, for example. What other kind of insights should people be keeping an eye on?
No, that's a good question. So I do frequently A-B testing just to test theories out. So especially when I'm doing this type of reporting, I might see like a particular graphic type is doing better than another. So for some reason, I haven't done this in years, but ugly graphics, and I mean like graphics that weren't done well, and I don't even know well, they just were weird colors, didn't look great, but they got so much engagement compared to like the pretty, like refined graphics. And it was so annoying. But stuff like that of like, what is different here? So anything that kind of doesn't make sense, I continue to track and kind of see. So I said producer, I said like content type, tone is another one. That one I do for A-B testing. And so I test like, oh, bold. And of course, you need to define what bold means for your organization. I do like a little key or something like that to define what bold is, or define what long is versus short on the particular social network, and do that way. Because that also not only helps you kind of figure things out. Before we started the podcast, I kind of alluded to different content on social can do different things. So I've been seeing some content, you know, gets more engagement, but it might not be the type of engagement I want. So they might get a lot of, you know, video views, but there's not a lot of conversation. So I did an A-B test for GIFs versus non-GIFs. And even though GIFs did well from, you know, they have views, so that boosts them up to a lot of the social networks anyway. But I realized a lot of people weren't commenting on them. And so now going back to the drawing board with the client of figuring out, is it because it's the GIF or is it because it's the type of GIF? So I tend to start maybe, you know, what I know, some big, broader things. And then as I go on, I get more niche, more niche, more niche, because as the data keeps, you know, coming and I'm developing insights, it's like, huh, is it because it's a video? Is it a GIF? Or is it because of the tone? Is it because of X? Or is it because the GIF was like a fake GIF and really could just have been a photo? You know, all GIFs aren't the same. So then it begs more questions. So you're like, great, I have more things to track. And you just keep going from there.
Yeah, I think the testing you mentioned is key, because even when you brought up the ugly photo thing, I wonder, is that just because people are so used to polished photos that it's standing out more, right? Like,
yeah, I think it's authenticity, because I noticed that with videos too. It was like when we had one of my clients had breaking news, didn't have the film crew, we just were like, let's do it on a phone. And it did amazingly well. And the person was flustered, like, I'm sorry, I'm flustered. I just got up, you know, this house vote. And, you know, I just had to let you know. And the audience loved it, because they were like, they felt the urgency. They didn't care that they were stumbling on words. They didn't care that their hair wasn't coiffed, and they didn't care that this wasn't some glossy video. They wanted the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think definitely after 2020, even it's people are even more amenable to just being real. Yeah. Yes. And overly polished. But yeah, I think it's all, I think in marketing across the board, it's this interesting balance between seeing what's already working and capitalizing on that, but then also doing something different that stands out from the crowd. And I assume the same thing happens on social. You're just constantly testing to see what's going to resonate.
Yeah, you do. Because the thing about social, it's always changing. I'm sure like everything else, but you know, you see all these new updates, these new things. And then of course the social networks want particular features to win. So then that, you know, dictates things. And right now, and even the landscape, I mean, Twitter in 2014 versus 2016 versus 2018 versus now, it's all different. And yeah. I bet, you know, Twitter seems to be leaning into becoming a place for creators with their, you know, acquisition of newsletter. And I guess you can start paid communities soon. And I feel like they want more creators, you know, who are on Instagram and TikTok coming to Twitter to make it a happier place, because no one wants to be on a humdrum social network. Like, I think that's no coincidence that TikTok took off during the pandemic, because you see happy people cooking and dancing and, you know, doing impressions, versus on Facebook you have people screaming at each other over politics. So then the social networks themselves, you know, want to change, because if people aren't happy on it, they don't get advertising dollars. So you always have to be, you can't really rest on your laurels with social, or probably anything, but definitely not social.
That's a really interesting point about Twitter. I didn't think about that in terms of why they were making some of these decisions. And, you know, right now, Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces, I think you mentioned on Twitter that you prefer Twitter Spaces. Yes. But with completely new social elements coming out, you know, in the case of Clubhouse, a completely new app, when should brands jump on these opportunities? Because I think sometimes they do and it doesn't really make sense for them to, but at the same time, it's exciting to get in on something emerging. What is your take on that?
So that's a good question. It'll be interesting to see how brands present themselves. Like, I know on Clubhouse, like over, you know, around Christmas, the Lion King was on Clubhouse and they did like the whole Lion King, you know, production.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it was like the 26th or something. I was watching, the Shonda Rhimes show on Netflix, darn it, Bridgerton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Watching Bridgerton with my family, so I couldn't check it out. But I saw the tweets about it and it looked amazing. So I think if brands like that, you know, figure out, like, that's something I want all day. But it seems like right now it makes more sense for the individuals. And I think brands might have to figure out how to tap into individuals, because I think people are just very sensitive now to being marketed to. They don't want to be interrupted. So the time to get in is when you can have value and integrate into the community, because, you know, no one wants to be interrupted with a sales pitch. And, you know, social, the organic, or at least the start of it, has always been around relationships and connections. And then, you know, it's evolved to sales and, you know, marketing and PR and all that. But the original thing is people wanting to connect with each other. And I think that's also people's preference. Yeah. So also kind of figuring out, I've had a client, this was way before Clubhouse, but, you know, they kind of unfortunately decimated their Facebook. They posted too much, too salesy. And they also unfortunately had brand partners that they allowed to also spam their audience. So no one was commenting on Facebook, but their audience, who are, you know, hyper users, they created their own Facebook. So wow. They could connect with each other. It's like a Facebook group. And they were, you know, very nice and let some of the organization in the group, so they could see kind of what was going on. And we had to protect that community from the organization, because they're like, well, no one shares our stuff, so let's throw it here. I'm like, no. The reason why they're not sharing is because you decimated them. You're not about to kill this community too. So they kind of had to find a way to integrate. And I think they helped come up with like a scavenger hunt, because they have a users conference. And this is another thing about listening. People would guess where the conference would be. So the brand, and I don't even think this came from the social team. I think it came from the community team, which is of course confusing. But anyway, the community team, because they work with the audience frequently, or the customer, they created, where in the world is it going to be? And they would give clues. And of course the audiences, I don't want to say, what are they? They're very studious, if you will. So they loved it. And so I gave a bunch of examples in that one thing, but yeah, you get in where you fit in, I guess, is the takeaway. Don't decimate the community. And you might have to use individuals and trust them and have your brand, you know, have them be an advocate or an influencer for your brand. But you stay away, because you will ruin everything.
Yeah, so it's a mindset thing. You can use a new platform if you're able to figure out how can I, is there a real authentic way for me to connect with my audience rather than just jumping on a platform and saying, yeah, let's do some stuff without really considering why.
Yeah, but you know, of course, all brands are different. Like if Lego did that, people would love that.
Right, that's true.
So you know, if you're a Lego, disregard what I said. I mean, except for decimating community, but you know, we would love to see you. If you're Staples, now no offense to Staples, but I don't think I'm going to a Staples clubhouse.
This has been great. I wanted to start wrapping up with a question. I think it was in a Muckrack post that you wrote. I'm going to link to it in the show notes because it's really great. It's about using metrics to get these insights.
Yeah.
It was either in that post or something else, but you had mentioned that you're not always going to be able to explain everything with numbers, right? Like it's just not going to happen. Is this important to when you're setting expectations with your clients?
It's really how you frame it, right? Like, for example, like yesterday, I was doing a strategy based off of information. You know, very, very limited information. So at a certain point, I had to give an educated guess. And, you know, instead of saying like, I don't know, I said, here's what the evidence says. Here's the gap that is missing. So impossible to tell. Based off of past information, we're going to proceed. And then I just say, and we'll test it. So when I don't know, and it's, you know, not possible at that moment, that's the testing opportunity.
Right.
Because there'll be something whenever the numbers don't make sense to me, like meaning for one client, if we post more and if we post more video, our metrics go up. It's just, that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. And especially if there's advertising in the mix, when those three things happen and the numbers go down, that tells me something is wrong and I have to figure out why, because that makes no sense. And then I found out, you know, digging deeper and deeper there, you know, there was a tone issue. There was like a controversy and our audience got mad at us. So there was a lot of things. Setting expectations of there's art and science, but there are a lot of unknowns. And so you do the best you can. And it doesn't happen often, but there's some times where I would say, I can't explain why this happened. Because after digging and digging and digging, and then giving that educated guess based off of the evidence, and then kind of giving the, you know, we'll evaluate by doing these, you know, few things going forward. Because I think some people, you know, like I said before, with the dashboards and we have more information than we've ever had before. It has set the expectation that everything should be solved and you should know everything. But things are complex, like communication, how people get information. You might not even know how you got information. You got an email, your mom told you, it was on the TV, it was on the presidential address. And you might kind of remember where you got the information, but you also might not. Does that mean none of this worked? No, it meant everything worked together. Can I attribute exactly? No, but I have an idea. I think setting expectations, but I think it's also how you frame it, because, you know, if you say, I don't know, they're like, what? But if you said like what I said, which is based off the information, blah, 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 and, you know, say it really educated, I haven't had anybody question me yet. So,
right. No, I think that's really helpful, the framing, because it's not, I don't know, like, okay, I didn't look into it, or I just don't know about this topic. It's, I looked into it thoroughly. This is my guess. And this is how we're going to figure it out in the future.
If it's possible to figure out, yes.
Right, right. That's really helpful. So Adrian, I wrap up shows by asking something kind of irrelevant to the topic this year. Okay. And that's by asking about creativity. So I've been interested to hear different people's perspectives on how they've been able to stay creative, especially in this time of a lot of us are working from home and, you know, and things are just kind of monotonous day to day. How are you able to stay creative?
Oh, I am glad you asked that, because I love creativity. So I do it in a few different ways. One is setting boundaries. And I'll explain that. And the other is setting myself up for success. And they kind of tie together. So for me, I have the attention span of a flea. So I am more creative when I have time, just point blank, when I have time, when I have, and so in order to have time, I have to create the time, which means I have to set boundaries. And I also need to know myself. So for example, because it takes me a while to get going, I will actually schedule meetings in between certain times on certain days, because it's like, I'm not going to get anything done anyway, so we might as well meet. But then I don't let any meeting, unless it's like a 5-alarm fire, come into another time. So basically the times where I notice I'm naturally more creative, that's the time I block off to actually think. The other thing is kind of working in an un-American way, meaning I noticed in myself, I felt like my to-do list, I felt maybe everyone does this, but I realized the to-do list is never ending because you're actually never done working. So I realized I was burning myself out to get through this to-do list. And I'm just like, why are you doing this? You're literally going to have more on this to-do list. So I started to actually make my to-do list more realistic for both like personal and professional, of like, if I have a bunch of meetings that day, I'm probably not going to do a good job with writing or anything else. So I intentionally schedule writing during a non-meeting day. And the boundaries are, I don't let people, you know, people want to get on the phone. You can't reach me on, I switched. So today is Thursday. Normally this is my no meeting day. So Wednesday was my no meeting day. And I got a lot done. And then when I said the un-American thing, I was feeling really stressed and burnout. I have a lot to do this week. And so I took off Monday, which sounds really backwards because like you have a lot to do. So you took a day off. But I got more done in Tuesday and Wednesday than I would have done if I worked Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday being burnt out. So it's really giving myself time. And then I was able to do something really creative on Tuesday or Wednesday or yesterday. I wouldn't have been probably as creative if I had worked on Monday, a full day.
Yeah. So, I've heard this described sometimes as like going with your flow. Like if you're in a writing flow, then just write no matter, you know, what you really had planned that day, if you're in a meeting flow.
Yes.
But you're making the really good point of the boundary setting, which I think is what a lot of people lack. They're like, sure, I'll do that. And then somebody pings them or they get an email and it just kind of implodes. I think that's a really crucial point that you brought up.
Yeah, technology has made it like you have to kind of almost reteach yourself. Just because I can answer that email right now doesn't mean I should. Just because I could meet now doesn't mean I should. And then, yeah, your point is great of, I also realized, or leaning into my mood, I think, I didn't mention, but you kind of said, is really, yeah, when I'm in a writing mood, my to-do lists are a little different now. They're like, this is what I generally want to get done. And I think before I would have been like, no, you're supposed to be working on X, but I'm like struggling to work on X. I really just want to write today. So now I give myself permission. Okay, fine. You write today, do that thing tomorrow or later today. So kind of stop putting myself like what, a round peg in a square hole, or square peg in a round hole, whatever.
No, I love all of that. Thank you so much for sharing that. So to wrap the show up, I always ask people, knowing the objective of the show, who would you recommend to be guests on future episodes?
Oh man. I wish you had asked this earlier so I could think.
No pressure. You can always follow up with me. I know some people are caught off guard by this.
Help me out. Like, what angle are you looking for?
You know, at this point, that's what I'm actually sort of struggling with. I'm like, what are the other approaches to this? Because it's all about understanding the value of content and or getting buy-in for it. And there's so many different aspects, even for just the buy-in part. You know, we've had some people come on and talk about more of the kind of top level approaches to even just persuasion, right? And getting people to see how it's going to benefit them at work. But then we get into like this episode, more like tactical stuff, right? Like, let's look at just social, let's look at just email. So there's a lot of different ways to come at it, I guess. And I know that's not a great answer to your question.
Okay, well, I'll throw someone out there because I think her name is Clarissa Lasky. Mm-hmm. Clarissa Explains It All. And she could probably talk about content from a few different perspectives, from a work perspective, and she actually is a travel parent blogger influencer. Nice. And she uses content or different social networks and different like strategies or whatever to really, you know, she didn't have to have a 9-to-5 for a while and, you know, chose to so she could, you know, have a steady paycheck and not whatever, but she still also has that and it brings extra money and happiness for her. So, and she leans into like Pinterest. She's taught me a lot about Pinterest. So
awesome.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, I very much appreciate that recommendation. I love to hear from other people and get perspectives like that, where they're doing things a different way, and we can all learn from that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Adrian, for being on the show and taking the time to share your perspective with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you've listened to this and want even more tips, sign up for our podcast newsletter by going to the podcast page on the Fractal website. And if you've learned anything from this show, we'd love it if you'd subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review. Finally, if you have feedback, suggestions, ideas, thoughts on whether Samoas or Tagalongs are the superior Girl Scout cookie, or anything you'd like to share with me, shoot me an email at amanda@frac.tl. I'm a shameless extrovert who would love to hear from you. Thank you to Sean Kelly for podcast music and editing, and to Joao Pereira for logo design. And thank you, dear listener. I hope you'll join us next time.